You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun.
The FBI is now investigating a shooting spree that left 8 people dead at multiple massage parlors in the Atlanta area. 6 of the 8 victims are of Asian descent.
Another mass shooting in America, a deadly rampage in a grocery store in Boulder, Colorado, leaving 10 people dead, several yet to be identified.
Those are the shootings you probably were told about last week. Then there are the ones you didn't hear about in California, Texas, and Pennsylvania. In fact, last week, there were 7 mass shootings in the U.S. in only 7 days. President Biden is urging Congress to take action. But we know how this usually plays out, right? Politicians offer thoughts and prayers and talk about the waste of innocent life, but nothing gets done. America's gun crisis feels hopeless. And it's not just fueling deadly violence here at home. It's fueling it abroad, too. So this week, we'll look at how America exports its gun problem to Mexico, Central America, and beyond. But first, Ray Suarez takes a closer look at the violence here at home and just how tricky it could be to fix it.
The United States has the highest number of civilian-owned firearms in the world. There are more privately owned guns in this country than there are people, and those guns are subject to far fewer restrictions than in other developed nations. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the U.S. suffers from more gun violence than other developed nations do as well. Our gun homicide rate is 6 times that of Canada's and 16 times that of Germany's. We also have the highest rate of gun-related suicides in the developed world. But the way gun violence manifests itself is complicated, and it'll take more than gun regulation to fix it. Take mass shootings. You might associate them with apparently random acts of mass murder at schools or grocery stores, but the reality is murkier. First, we can't even agree on what a mass shooting actually is. Law enforcement agencies don't have one standard agreed-upon definition. The nonprofit Gun Violence Archive defines mass shooting as an incident when 4 or more people are shot. So that's what we're using here. And some communities are victimized by mass shootings a lot more than others.
They actually seem to affect Black communities more so than other communities.
J. Brian Charles covers guns, race, and inequality for The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom entirely focused on covering gun violence in the U.S. In 2020, he and his colleagues spent months tracking a shooting surge in American cities.
If you look at Chicago, for example, through September, Chicago had 36 mass shooting events in the entire city. 31 were in the majority Black neighborhoods. In Philadelphia, they had 18 through September, and 11 of those were in majority Black neighborhoods. I just want to be clear, we tracked those through September of last year, and they were up compared to other years. We had a lot more of them. So that actually continued to happen. It just continued to happen in places that for a lot of reasons don't receive the level of coverage that other types of events happen.
As the pandemic intensified in 2020, American cities locked down. Burglary rates dropped. So did traffic stops and drug offenses. But fatal shootings spiked around the country. I talked with J. Brian Charles to find out why. J. Brian Charles, welcome to World Affairs.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, we spent a year apart, in many cases isolated, more lonely, away from the workplace, away from people we know, yet the number of shootings went up. How do we understand that?
So early on in the pandemic, and some of my colleagues started to look at what we saw was a trend in an uptick in shootings right around the time we saw closures. And what you started to see was a lot more of these violent acts happening in places like Philadelphia. Baltimore had a high number of homicides. So did Chicago. And one of the theories that was put out there was that the pandemic itself caused a lapse of what we call informal guardianship. This is where you have people that are on the street that may not be involved in the conflict, but they could potentially be witnesses in this. And therefore, sometimes that particular act will stop an act from happening. That was part of it. The other part of it is there is a theory out there that the police pulled back a little bit, not a blue flu scenario, but more of a situation in which they were worried about contracting the virus or spreading the virus, so they weren't getting out making contact as much. And the third thing that kind of happened here was that the kind of street outreach workers that you see in places like Chicago with the cure violence model there, here in Baltimore, to some degree in Philadelphia and other places, they had a harder time making connections to people on ground level to resolve some of these conflicts before they turned violent. Those are some of the things that we saw.
So the restraint that might be present in the form of eyes on the street was less present. And what, the beefs just kept on going? If you had something that was already in play that you had against someone else, it was now easier to shoot them?
There was less of a presence on the street that may discourage someone from taking that type of action. But the other thing also is that some of the natural rhythms of a day got thrown off. And some of those are, well, I go to work every day, right? And maybe I have a conflict with a guy, if you're a younger person, and I might go to school, or I might go to my job, or I might be doing something else during the day. And that sometimes has the ability to stretch this conflict out to where a couple of hours later, I may not be as hot and bothered as I was early on, and take this beef to a violent conclusion. The other thing is you think about these folks being in these neighborhoods with little resources. There's not a lot of money, no job to go to. Well, there's no cooling off period. That's what one person who does gun violence prevention work told me, is that where do people go to cool off? And you saw these things flare up quite a bit. So in the cities that we were looking at, and the ones that I follow closely, which are Philadelphia and Baltimore, we have 499 homicides in Philadelphia, which is a decades high number for Philadelphia. Baltimore got to 335, which unfortunately in Baltimore, we've had 300 plus homicides for six straight years. That number approaches the most recent high, which was 349 homicides in 2019. When we talk about violence, the one thing that we can always count firmly is a homicide number, because you have a person here that is marked as not being with us anymore. The number here for shootings, for non-fatal shootings, is somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 a year. And somebody acutely pointed out to me, and that's the people who show up to the hospital, and that's the people who actually get hit. That's not the number of shootings.
We've had recent mass casualty shootings, and they tend to get the lion's share of attention. But it's really people getting shot one at a time that's giving us these decades-long highs in casualties on the streets of American cities, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I will say a couple of things about that. I think one of the things that we spend a lot of time in the media focusing on is mass shootings. Some of the violence in this country that we pay attention to, and for good reasons, we pay attention to like the AR-15 and the semi-automatic assault rifles. But, you know, the driver of violence in a city like the city I'm in is small handguns. It's 38s and 380s and 9mm. That's what you're seeing out here. So, yes, a lot of the focus is always on the bigger event. It's kind of one of the things that news organizations can easily grab onto. I don't want to be too glib here, but the drip of regular homicide, sometimes it's hard for people to, you know, get their head around and contextualize.
That flow of the handguns that are causing most of the casualties, most of the deaths. What is it about American law that makes it possible? There's a river of iron running through the streets of American cities, even though many of them have laws that, on the books, make it hard to get a gun.
I live in Baltimore and I write in Baltimore. And so let's take that we have had, and you can look at Ron Cassie's work at Baltimore Magazine. He wrote about this. We have a steady flow of weapons to this city all the time, coming from as far away as Texas and California, but as close as Pennsylvania and Virginia, North Carolina. So if you think about this, you can have strict gun laws in a place like Maryland or in a city like Baltimore. You can do a lot of work to grab and remove these guns. Although that work in Baltimore has been successful and controversial at the same time. But the problem with it is that I can go to Virginia and buy a gun in the morning and be back by lunchtime. You know, it's not far from Baltimore to Virginia. I think the other thing that we have to contend with, and this is important, is, and as one police officer said to me, he says, you know, you can make a gun rather quickly and you can always replace a gun with a gun. But some of the things that are creating the conditions that create people who would want to shoot people are some of the deeper issues that also need to be solved at the same time.
Are we making an error in emphasis by putting so much attention on the guns themselves and relatively less on the conditions that create the conflict? It sounds like it would be really tough and highly intense in manpower terms to try to short-circuit those conflicts instead of stopping people from getting guns.
Yes and no. This is a both-and situation. We need to start looking at alternatives to just law enforcement responding to these things, right? So if you think about the way violence impacts cities, a lot of the violence is concentrated in a handful of neighborhoods. A street gang is often a 19 to 22-year-old in charge of 17-year-olds. I don't know if I was the wisest decision maker and person to manage an organization of 17 and 16-year-olds when I was 21 or 22. I mean, we know from some cognitive science that they're not even fully cooked and developed yet. And so you would have to go in with all manner of services, social services, psychological services, mental health services, a bunch of other things that you need to go into focus in those areas to try to interrupt this kind of cyclical nature of trauma, where trauma gets passed on from one person to the next person to the next person and passed on from generation to generation. Because the one thing about the weaponry here is it's extremely portable. But one could argue that so is the other conditions that create the type of environment that becomes that hostile, that's extremely portable and spreadable too. The way to get at that is to try to employ more than just a law enforcement response, or to employ a response that includes health departments, it includes, you know, schools, it includes some of the street outreach workers. It really is an all hands on deck thing.
When I covered street gangs in various places, I was always struck by the kind of nihilism that was part of our conversations. I would talk to gang boys and they would, not to just sound tough, but just incidentally, it always came back to me just how often they would express a sort of nonchalance about inflicting real damage on other human beings and having it inflicted on them in the process. They all knew people who had been killed. That was very common. They knew people who had died young from a wide variety of causes and seemed to hold their lives as less valuable as a result.
Yeah. And also, I kind of hold on to one thing that I remind myself of: when the game appears to be rigged, the rules don't matter. Like if I'm in the city that I live in now, right, and our city is starkly divided along race and economic lines, right, and I can see easily that there's a group of people who don't look like me, who don't have my life experience, who seem to be, you know, it looks like Bacchanal over there. It looks like an embarrassment of riches. And meanwhile, the best that I may be able to hope for is $12 an hour at a fulfillment center in where a steel plant used to be in Baltimore, right? That doesn't look like the best trade-off in the world. And that's not really the most hopeful thing in the world. And I'm not excusing a violent behavior. I'm just saying that a 19-year-old making longitudinal decisions about their life is not necessarily the best person making those decisions, but also importantly, they're not stupid and they can see that this thing looks a little bit rigged, and then you can be led into a lot of decision making that may not be the decisions that you or I might make.
Is Baltimore's condition so isolated from that of the rest of the country that if what economists are saying is in the cards, a slingshot rebound, a lot more people going back to work, a lot more money coursing through the system, is that going to bring a reduction when we count up the numbers next year?
So here's the issue that I have, is that we have an economy that has been cleaved apart this is not new. This has been like this for decades. We are not alone in that. There is a lot of cities like that. And I think if you dig deep enough, even in the most successful, prosperous cities, you see an entire section of the population that's being left out. I mean, DC has been on a tear the last couple of years, both in gun violence, but also it is a place that is a hotbed for business and economic growth. But yet the disparity between black and white unemployment rates in DC are among the greatest disparity of any metro area in the country. You know, black folks are unemployed at, I think, four times the rate than white folks are unemployed in that city. And remember, that's a plurality black city. It's like 48, 49%. So a whole section of the city is being left out from whatever that slingshot rebound was, because they were left out from the historic decade of growth that would precede any slingshot rebound. So I don't know if that's going to change much.
If after this interview, you and I both go to the television and turn on C-SPAN, and there is yet another debate in the House or Senate about gun violence, about the number of Americans who die from the use of firearms, what do you expect you'd find them missing in the conversation? What is it that, now that you've been immersed in this world for a couple of years now, you'd be driven around the bend yet again by what it is that they are either avoiding talking about or just don't know to talk about?
I think it's some of the social and emotional drivers behind that. A lot of that is stuff that we've been talking about for a couple of decades, but I don't think that those conversations have surfaced in a way that mainstream politicians want to talk about it. I mean, we have to be very, very cognizant of the fact that we just recently, and I mean very recently, got away from lock them up, go after them, grab everybody, sweep corners. And to some degree, on a local level, we haven't really stopped doing that. So having a real thorough conversation of not that we are violent or we have violence in this country, but why we have it, we're still in the very, very, very early stages of that. And then we're in the stages of it that I don't know if people inside the Beltway who are decision makers are having that conversation often enough to really start to wrap their head around it.
What would a serious conversation about guns and our future look like? What should we be talking about that we're not right now?
We should be talking, yes, about the proliferation of firearms in this country. That is a serious conversation. We should also be talking about the role of law enforcement. We do have to, in some ways, extract some of the worst actors from the equation. We have to start talking about what conditions are producing this kind of desperation, the desperation that you spoke about in those young boys in the street gang. I mean, why people join street gangs in the first place? Like, why is that a thing? I don't know if we're being as forthright and serious about wanting to end this until we have the conversation about all those things. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're just applying a set of political solutions that fit the desires of sometimes the people who are least affected by this, right? Because in the end, you know, this violence is visiting people in largely in low-income neighborhoods and distressed neighborhoods. And, you know, meanwhile, the conversation is being had by people who don't even live there. And I guess maybe to some degree also including people in those neighborhoods in the conversation. They know what's needed where they live.
Brian Charles is a journalist in Baltimore, Maryland. He writes about gun violence, race, and inequality for The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom. Brian Charles, great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're listening to World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. That was Ray Suarez with J. Brian Charles, a reporter based in Baltimore covering guns, race, and inequality for The Trace. Baltimore has the highest gun homicide rate in any city in the U.S., despite Maryland's restrictive gun laws. And as Charles just pointed out, one of the reasons for this unexpected fact is that guns are flooding in from other states. Arms traffickers thrive on America's inconsistent gun laws and buy what they need in states like Florida or Georgia. And these lax gun laws on the books in some states, they just don't fuel gun trafficking here. Every year, thousands of military-style weapons flow south of the border and into the hands of cartels and gangs in Latin America who are running a multinational drug trade. To find out more, Ray Suarez talked with Yon Grillo. He's the author of Blood, Gun, Money: How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. Their conversation was recorded back in February, before most of the recent mass shootings. As a warning, this conversation includes some descriptions of graphic violence.
Diving into the grotesque violence of Mexican drug cartels isn't for the faint-hearted. Homicide rates have been steadily increasing in that country.
So far this year, more than 1,700 people have been murdered in the city of Tijuana.
As the violence throughout Mexico spikes, murders are also on the rise.
Another bloody crime scene in Jalisco State.
Journalist Yon Grillo has been following this gang warfare for two decades.
Right behind me is the body of a man who's been murdered.
It's been horrific, and there's many things that I've seen which I couldn't have believed I would ever see. I mean, being in a morgue with 49 bodies that were found on a road, all of them decapitated, all of them with their hands and their feet cut off. One of the biggest mass killings there's been here. And talking to many, many family members, and you see, you know, it's seeing the mothers' faces when they describe how they're looking for their son. One woman I talk about in the book, she was searching for her son who went missing in 2013. He went missing because he was working in customs. He was around his girlfriend's house, family's house. A group of armed guys came in and just took him away in front of the family, just took him away. A young guy in his 20s. And she couldn't find anything from him, saw nothing from him. You know, where was he? Where is this guy? Where is her son? And searching, the police couldn't help. So we were just searching for years and years. Eventually in 2017, there was a bunch of these mothers who all got together searching for their children, were marching on Mother's Day when this guy rolls up in a car and he hands them a hand-drawn map. And they look at this map and they he's just like, check it out. And they go to the police with this, and the police still don't do anything. So they personally go to this field and start digging up and finding these bodies there. This is right next to a residential neighborhood. So the neighbors there are complaining, saying, well, we're getting the smell of this death. When you dig up these mass graves, this kind of haunting smell of the rotting flesh or the decayed bodies. And they find more than 250 bodies or remains of people, I mean, skulls, different body parts in this mass grave, the biggest mass grave in Mexico in recent history. Still, this is 2017. And when I talked to her then, and she was still trying to identify it, eventually in 2019, it was identified that her son was found among the dead there. So the horrific human cost. But why is it happening? You know, what is the logic behind this?
This is the question Grillo tries to answer in his most recent book, Blood, Gun, Money: How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. You open the book with the trial of El Chapo Guzman, who was extradited to New York to stand trial for running narcotics into the U.S. And it's almost hard to believe cumulatively what a mountain of drugs it must have been, $14 billion worth, according to prosecutors. Did we learn anything important about the man, what he did, what men like him do on both sides of the border?
Well, I think that trial was like accumulation of the war on drug strategy first defined by Richard Nixon back in 1971.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
When he said he wanted this war on drugs, the drugs were public enemy number one in American life. And the idea that drugs would be abolished and there wouldn't be any heroin in American life, that people wouldn't have this problem to deal with. So you saw people going up, you know, they realized you can't just arrest the guy on the corner selling heroin. You've got to sell the person who sells heroin to him, and then that person and that person, till you get to the real kingpins.
Today, the lead agency in that fight is the Drug Enforcement Administration.
When President Nixon formed the DEA in 1973, he declared an all-out global war on the drug menace. Successive presidents embraced the war on drugs with even greater vigor.
Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted.
We have worked very hard with the Colombians and with others in South America, and you see the results.
Now, we have Pablo Escobar, who was shot dead in 1993, but that wasn't really a DEA American achievement. In many ways, that was a Colombian achievement, although Americans were involved.
The killing of Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar is sending a tougher message. At least that is the hope of Colombian and U.S. officials. Colombian authorities say its message to other drug lords is to surrender or you will be killed.
But El Chapo was really the biggest drug trafficking kingpin prize the United States got. So you had this showcase trial with more than 50 witnesses, various major drug traffickers themselves, former lovers, people talking about El Chapo in all these ways. And I think what we learned from this big show trial that eventually sent El Chapo to life in the Supermax prison is this doesn't change the drug trade. It doesn't change the violence. Sadly, we've seen over in 2020 record overdose deaths in the United States from drugs. And we've seen in Mexico another horrendous year of murders, 34,500 murders, more than 70% with firearms. So this tragedy carries on.
Let's talk some more about that intimate connection that you illustrate between guns and drugs. Why do they accompany each other along the smuggling routes and in the cash deals in so many places in the world?
Like I describe this as like two plants, venomous plants wrapped around each other. So you see drugs and guns together in so many places. I mean, if you go to Baltimore, to the street corners where people are selling drugs, and then people have illegal guns, and they will often trade drugs for guns. I interview a guy who's in a prison gang called the Dirty White Boys from Maine, who was getting these guns in these small towns, taking them into the cities, trading with drug dealers, drugs for guns again. Then you see this down in Mexico, the cartels running guns, and down to Colombia, the trading of firearms for kilos of cocaine. People can buy a kilo of cocaine in Colombia for $2,000. When you get that to the US border, it's worth $30,000. And when it goes breaking down into New York or Washington, it can be more than $150,000. So that's why this business, everyone wants to get involved, and the most violent people get involved in this business. And then while the drugs go north, we see the firearms also connected to this business and rolling south.
You write that the weapons El Chapo bought and sold formed a large branch of the quote-unquote Iron River that flows between the legal and illegal arms trades. You describe it as a river defended in part by the National Rifle Association and the Second Amendment fundamentalists everywhere, while making people like Chapo Guzman rich. Explain that.
So the United States has the biggest legal firearms retail market in the world by far. The number of guns in civilian hands is more than the next 25 countries combined. You know, we're talking about the last count was 393 million firearms, but now it's likely over 400 million more guns are churned out every year. Now, a lot of those guns in civilian hands don't necessarily do major harm to people if people have guns locked in safes, if they go hunting, if they happen to protect their family. But a lot of these guns then go to criminals and gangsters and people who they want to kill. They have these guns for the purpose of committing murder, defending drug deals and this kind of thing. You see this inside the United States and the flow of guns to cities like Baltimore, which I look at in the book, like Washington, New York, Chicago, and various places. But you also see a flow south to Mexico and to more than 100 countries, to the Caribbean, to Central America, to South America, and even far beyond the oceans. Now, the flow to Mexico, we've seen, and there's no discussion about this. This is totally confirmed. There's more than the last 12 years, 164,000 firearms taken from criminals here in Mexico, from cartel members and other criminals, and traced directly to the United States. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. They believe that the actual number estimated by the Mexican government and also estimated by a university in San Diego is more than 200,000 firearms a year, so 2 million firearms in the last decade. And we've seen in Mexico what really is like a hybrid mix of crime and war here with this. So it's kind of a historic episode of trafficking guns to a very violent conflict, one of the most violent conflicts in the world right now. So what you have is you have these two illegal markets, the illegal drug trade and the illegal gun trade. Now, they have different logics. The drug trade is making huge, huge amounts of money, but it's so easy in a way to do that it's the most violent people who will take control of this business. So people want firearms to be able to control those profits. Now, the gun, illegal gun trade, people can make money, but it's far less than drugs. And guns go through weird, quite elastic prices. The guns are a commodity used to defend this other illegal racket. So you see then these smuggling routes, like these cartels that have the routes into the United States, and they have these trap cars, cars with hidden compartments that can roll south with guns. I interview a pilot who worked for the Sinaloa cartel, who's currently incarcerated in North Carolina, a guy who came from an upper middle class background and became a pilot for the cartel. At times was worth tens of millions of dollars. But he described how he would fly these planes down to Colombia to pick up cocaine and then fly back to Mexico. And these people are businessmen. They want to make money. So it was a waste of money to fly with an empty plane down to South America, put something in it. You know, what do the Colombians want? Firearms. The Mexicans can get firearms from the United States. So you see these firearms that move around the United States turning up in Colombia, and they're taking these guns that, again, are coming out of the U.S. retail industry.
But you yourself point out in the course of the story that there's something fundamentally different about a gun when compared with a key of cocaine. People snort the cocaine. People use the cocaine. They inject the cocaine. They cook the cocaine. But it's gone after that. A gun is an unusually durable consumer durable. And yet, people need more and more of them.
Yes, this is a great point. So you see these different businesses, and so you have this difference of a durable good versus a consumer good. And so people are churning out cocaine all the time. People are just consuming it, and it's worth these huge amounts of money. I mean, according to a White House survey, Americans spend $150 billion a year on illegal drugs. But as you say, the gun is a durable good. Now, this is an issue for gun companies, for firearms companies, because they need to keep markets going. So you see in the United States, the collections, the number of guns is really high, but actually less of a percentage of the population have firearms. And you find, you know, many people, like a guy I interview in the book from Alaska, from the Alaska Machine Gun Association, who has more than 200 guns in the basement of his home. But with the guns going into these conflict zones, because there's a conflict happening and they're losing guns to law enforcement, people are being shot and dying all the time, then having this iron pipeline pumping the weapons in allows them to always have new guns, brand new guns, clean guns, and it makes the conflict worse, the pure quantity of firearms. So we see a thing where criminals, cartel members, or gangs in the United States, when a gun is used in many murders, they will often consider that to be a burned gun, something which has been used, you know, that can be traced. So they want to get rid of it. So they will sell that onto the street. They will unload that onto the street. And that can be unloaded for, you know, a cheap price, $100, $200.
In border cities like Ciudad Juarez, with one of the highest murder rates in the world, these cheap, plentiful guns find their way into the hands of school children.
So you see these murders of children, teenagers, happening in Mexico as well, alongside this bigger violence of cartels. So it's constantly everything being at boiling point.
Where the gun violence spreads, its effects are amplified by the sheer volume of hardware available. there's no limit on the amount of ammunition one purchaser can buy in America, and no background checks are required. This makes bullets harder to trace than guns, and the steady stream of ammunition allows cartels to fire round after round at their targets, resulting in inevitable tragedies for ordinary civilians.
Soldiers themselves in war zone will often be more careful with their bullets, or police officers, and only fire a bit more conservatively, not just be spraying. But in Mexico, they will get these AK-47s, and then there's many of these scenes I've been at where they spray more than 500 bullets at their victims. So you see the scene where they'll like spray on a car to get the target they're looking at, and then the car behind might be a woman driving to work. She's full of bullets and dead as well. And the guy on the street selling tacos on the street is also full of bullets and dead. So that's another reason, if you look at the murder numbers in Mexico, how this is so bad. And we're talking about more than 300,000 homicides over the last decade. But another thing, a tragic story, also in Honduras, was a girl who survived a stray bullet. She was very shy about telling the story, but the story I heard was some gang members went into her neighborhood and fired at her brother. Some of the bullets ricocheted and they hit her in the waist, and she was paralyzed from the waist down at 12 years old. Now, I interviewed her when she was 14 years old, and she would not go to school because the school had no wheelchair ramps in her. This is a school in San Pedro Sula, Honduras. So I asked, you know, what do you do all day? And she was like, I just like lie down watching TV. This was like very heartbreaking to see this. A girl of that age kind of losing her potential, suffering, already living in having all the strikes against her. Now, I learned just in the last week that she actually has passed away. I think wounds still came from that shooting, and she passed away. I mean, this is a humanitarian catastrophe. And so many of these being civilians, being regular people, and that's even before we get to the actual deliberate targeting and kind of terrific abuse of civilians by both cartels and sometimes the security forces fighting them.
I wanted to ask you about that, because along with what you describe as the collateral damage, the guy selling corn on the cob on the sidewalk, the person waiting in the next car, there are mass killings, over-the-top depravity, cruelty, the extent, the mutilations, the beheadings, the almost ritualistic nature of some of these killings. Why is it happening there? Why is it happening like that?
It's a question I've wrestled with for the years. And I think part of that, you can see in an interview I do in the book as well with a hitman actually in Honduras, a guy called Fresa. His nickname is Fresa, who I met several times in Honduras. He's now been himself murdered. But he described from the personal point of view of a hitman in this, from his own personal story, was that he was abandoned as a child. And he felt that he hated the world, that the world had been treated him badly, so why should he care about other people? Now, one of the tragedies is that he would work as a hitman. He would take life for money, and he committed a horrific amount of murders. But he was at the time, and the time I knew him and interviewed him, trying to provide a middle-class life for his two children and not the life on the street that he had, this real life of that he felt of kind of humiliation and starving and wanting. And then he ended up himself being murdered, so he then left his children as orphans. But he would describe as well why the cruelty, the decapitations that were given in these contract killings. And he would say it would often be written in these contracts. They would want to use this, especially as acts of revenge if money had been stolen. And again, it gets back to this issue that drugs are easy to move into traffic it's a business that involves so much money and everybody's stealing money, people not paying each other back. So violence is the way you try and keep control of this, and extreme violence or terror. So they really do use this cruelty, these terror tactics to a very extreme level. Now, I also see, again, and this gets back to the guns, the level of guns and the type of weaponry we've seen here. It's, you know, you have huge amounts of AR-15, AK-47s. They also have grenades, which they get from old stockpiles like in El Salvador, which was supplied to the El Salvadoran government in a civil war there by the United States in that case as well. You have these big 50 caliber rifles that fire bullets the size of small knives. And you see in a video from the fighting in the city of Culiacán, Mexico, Culiacán, Sinaloa, and that was where you had Chapo's son, Ovidio, was arrested, and then you had 700 to 800 hitmen fighting the military. And there's video there where they fire a 50 cal and the soldier's leg is literally blown off. It literally goes to pieces with this. So those are weapons of war, weapons of mass destruction.
This war between the cartels and the Mexican government escalated during the presidency of Felipe Calderón. Within days of taking office in 2006, he launched a military offensive against the cartels and continued a decapitation strategy throughout his presidency.
Now, Felipe Calderón himself was bringing the issue of illegal American guns going to Mexico to the table.
I have come here as your neighbor, as your partner, as your ally, and as your friend.
He went to a joint session of US Congress and he addressed this issue and said, this is a problem we have to look at.
75,000 guns and assault weapons in Mexico in the last 3 years. And more than 80% of those we have been able to trace came from the United States.
So there was pressure from a high level to go after these illegal firearms. And I was in Mexico in 2009, the first visit by Barack Obama, and he was questioned again about firearms and said, oh, you know, we can't get a ban, but we can try and do some things within the law against these firearm trafficking.
But behind Calderón's back, the ATF launched a new mission to trace the path of guns trafficked across the U.S.-Mexico border. It was called Operation Fast and Furious.
So Fast and Furious was an operation by the ATF, the gun police, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, in 2009 to 2010.
It was supposed to target what was known as straw buyers, ordinary people with clean records who would buy guns on behalf of criminal gangs. These guns would then be transferred into the hands of cartels.
So they were going to these gun shops and buying guns. But the ATF said, well, we can't just arrest them. Other people will do it. We need to build up a big conspiracy-style case, like the case against El Chapo, this kind of thing.
The agency put tracers inside the guns. These tracers were supposed to monitor the weapon's location, track their journey into cartel hands, and allow the ATF to build a body of evidence against gang members. By the end of 2010, 1,400 guns that had been part of this tracing scheme disappeared, just fell off the map. Then some of them showed up at the killing of a Border Patrol agent.
Border Patrol agent Brian Terry was gunned down near the Mexican border last December.
And then you got whistleblowers with the ATF talking about this operation, and it became a big, big scandal. Now, I believe it was more of a screw-up than a really conspiratorial action.
This operation, which kept Calderón and his government in the dark, has had far-reaching consequences. Some of the missing guns were later discovered at El Chapo's last known safe house.
My emphasis was to make Mexico a rule of law country.
As part of his reporting for Blood, Gun, Money, Grillo talked with Felipe Calderón about all of this.
We never realized that it was going to be a complete disorder, and it went out of control of the Attorney General office. No? And afterwards, we discovered through the conversation with the Zetas leader that definitely there were American agents in complicity with the Zetas. No?
So you think now that the Fast and Furious was badly managed? I mean,
definitely. It is needed to have a lot of cover operations, to have the judicial evidence to put in trial on all those criminals, definitely. I don't see many other ways to do that. This, I think, could be a good idea, but it was a horrible implementation.
If operations to prevent guns from traveling across the border are problematic, what about going back to the source? In his book, Grillo traces guns all the way to the places they were made, on the other side of the Atlantic, in Eastern Europe.
You see the guns from Eastern Europe, which are being made in factories, and they're coming to the United States, coming to the Americas, also going to these same factories making guns, which end up with the Islamic State, which end up in these war zones in Africa. There's one person I talked to, I think, who gave an honest, if slightly amoral, quote, who was a gun broker in Bulgaria.
How did you get into this business? How old are you?
I'm 32 years.
32 years old. But,
and he was saying that, you know, he was a young guy in Bulgaria, which is not a rich country. And he had two houses, four cars, motorcycles. He said, it's great. This business gives me money. I couldn't make anything anywhere else. And he'd fly around to these African capitals and to Saudi Arabia, to these places, and make these deals of selling AK-47s, selling hardware. And I said to him, well, you know, do you feel bad if the guns that you sell end up with the Islamic State, end up, you know, with murderers? And he said, well, no, I don't feel bad if the paperwork is good, if the paperwork is solid. If I sell them, for example, to Saudi Arabia, and you know, somehow they end up in the hands of the Islamic State, that's not my problem. You know, if in the United States, if you're selling it, you know, there's a company importing AK-47s into the United States with a big warehouse in Vermont. So I said to him, you might not feel bad legally, but do you feel bad ethically? And he stood there for a moment, and then he said, no. And it was a very honest answer. So there is that immoral side. And I think people saying, well, this is just a business we're in. It's not our problem what people use these guns for. We're providing a tool that can be used for good or bad. If we look around the world, there's countries that do manage to achieve much more stopping guns being in the hands of criminals. And we see that in Europe. We saw this after the wave of shooting terrorist attacks in France, in Europe, around 2015. And I look at the Bataclan massacre and trace those guns, which came from a factory in Serbia. There was a big effort to clamp down on firearms after those shootings. And then we saw a few attacks last year, but often they were with knives or other weapons and doing much less damage. I mean, talking about another reason why guns are worse than knives, which is, you know, really quite elemental thing. You know, we see things like a lot of knife crime in London and a lot of gangs in London. But you see there murder rates of things like 1.5 per 100,000. And then you see these gangs in Baltimore and murder rates of 40, 50 per 100,000, so like 35 times higher. And you look at these areas, you look at the gangs, they're not that radically different. So obviously guns are a factor there. We see even in some US cities, and you saw in New York, a decrease in murders in New York for various reasons between 1990 and the mid-2010s. It's bouncing back last year, unfortunately, tragically. But there was an effort to suppress and to try and reduce the number of firearms around. So you can see successes. Now, in Mexico, people do say, well, in Mexico, the cartels will get guns. If it's not from the United States, it will be directly from China or other places. If you make it more difficult, guns become more expensive and you don't have as many firearms all the time. And right now, the effort is not being made. I mean, right now we have a situation where people are walking into gun shops in Phoenix and buying 50 cal rifles that are being used. And we see this in cities like Culiacan blowing the leg off a soldier. We see people walking to the shop and buying 10 of the same AK-47 and that being taken to cartels. Now, there's ways I believe that this can be slowed not necessarily stopped. I don't want to be talking in absolutist, unrealistic terms, but it can be slowed without violating the Second Amendment rights of Americans.
One of the big hurdles in doing that is to strip the conversation, strip the debate of a kind of disingenuousness, which is kept at the heart of it by institutions like the NRA. They talk about guns as if they're sort of inert objects that don't really do anything bad. It's just bad people that do things. But a gun delivers more power, more destructive power, in return for as little physical effort as you can imagine. You know, I've often spoken with NRA defenders and NRA leaders, and they say, look, you can murder someone with a baseball bat, and people do. You can murder someone with a knife, and people do. And while that's very true, boy, oh boy, it is a lot harder to murder someone with a baseball bat than it is to shoot them from 25 yards away. And the destructive power of an AR-15 isn't even like that of a handgun. It liquefies the body parts. The round moves at such an incredible speed that it just tears people to pieces. And yet we can't, for example, talk about the AR-15 as if it's something different from a 38 or a 22, which it is. There is a difference between guns, but you can't even have that conversation with the NRA. A gun is a gun is a gun.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in terms of the NRA itself, you see this kind of mutation in the NRA, and you go back to their history, and they were originally founded in New York. And they originally had a guy who worked for the New York Times, of all places. And you had these veterans from the North in the Civil War wanted to say we had to practice straight shooting. And originally the NRA were in favor of regulations on firearms. And you saw that in 1934 in the act then, when you start to see these people with Tommy guns firing, you know, the Al Capone era. And then you saw that again in 1968, when you had these shootings of JFK, of Martin Luther King Jr., you then also saw the NRA supporting regulations. But the NRA then really radicalized in the 1970s. And you had this figure, Harlan Carter, who was somebody who had, in fact, himself, when he was 17 years old, shot dead a 15-year-old Mexican youth on the border area, which he eventually was released for, and who rose to head the Border Patrol. And then he went on to have this much more radical position that guns are needed. We have to fight against any kind of gun control. It's all a slippery step. And then you saw, I think, a mutation again more recently, another mutation, where the NRA became in some ways very much a kind of media machine of selling the lifestyle to these people. And it was very much the same kind of rhetoric it got of Trump, of the media are all the enemy. I mean, there's various curses against the media being made by NRA members. The elite want to take away your guns. So kind of playing to the lifestyle, but making money and getting funds from selling this idea of a war, a crusade. And then you get this even more extreme end of the gun rights movement, of people saying things like anybody who dies in a mass shooting is a crisis actor, that even felons and criminals should have guns. It's a God-given right. I say you can look at these measures that do not really, that should not even be controversial, like the universal background check. Now, that is supported, according to surveys, by 89% of Americans and 81% of conservatives, even the majority of gun owners. And it's simply saying if you buy a gun, they run the background check. If you've got somebody who's committed murders, who's a gang member, then you can at least find that in the background check. Another measure is this issue of straw purchases, like these people in the Fast and Furious. Most of the time, when they get caught, they get probation. They don't get a sentence. So you get cases like a guy who went into a shop and bought 10 AK-47s. One of those AK-47s was used directly in the murder of an American ICE agent in Mexico. The guy still only got probation. So again, and in fact, you don't need to change the law. Simply, if the sentencing guidelines were up and you said to people, if you sell guns to cartels, you get in a prison time, it's enforcing the laws there. So these are the measures. I mean, other things like, for example, if somebody's buying a 50 cal, and if you get like a 22-year-old guy going and pay $10,000, $12,000 in cash for a 50 cal, it's got to be suspicious. There should be red lights there. Simply say, can we just, you know, check this out? But there's ways, I think, that can be done, basic stuff that can be done that can reduce the death in this problem.
What can we expect in the future? In Mexico, President López Obrador has proclaimed a policy of hugs, not bullets, and signaled an end to the combative policies of his predecessors. In the United States, President Biden is trying to turn a wave of mass shootings into a call to action. His administration is pushing to enact stricter gun control measures, like banning assault weapons and increasing background checks. The reforms are widely supported by Democratic and Republican voters, but they're still unlikely to pass in the Senate. Senate Republicans have already objected to the bills, arguing they infringe on Second Amendment rights.
There is a window of opportunity now, but this is an issue which is not going away. So even if things do not happen now, this issue is going to be around in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years. And I really don't think, the support for this is big. There's a massive window of opportunity. However, that's the hopeful side. The bad side is that American politics is quite broken in many ways. And we'll see if this is really addressed. There also is a certain level of friction between Mexico and the United States right now in terms of tackling organized crime, drug trafficking. And there is very valid continued accusations of corruption within Mexico and drug cartel members.
One roadblock, one impediment, perhaps would be the gun absolutists. And gun people love guns. They want them. In many cases, they hold up the gun as an essential good that trumps other considerations. Are they willing to put up with the annual death toll?
Well, you had the NRA exercising a power in Washington, which is unrivaled. And I think it's a case study in how to exert power in modern politics over many years. And they did this with this kind of idea of single issue voters. You have gun voters, that's what they're going to vote on, and that's it. And they have this idea of kind of having this crusade. And a lot of the time you do see extremists defining these debates and fighting any kind of regulation. However, when you actually sit down and talk to many gun owners, and like another guy interviewed in the book is the guy who runs the AR-15 Owners of America. So you might think that sounds like quite a hardline group. But still, I say to this guy who's a military vet, I said to him, you know, how about actually if there were these regulations about trying to stop these firearms going to cartels, going to gangsters, going to mass shooters? And he said, well, you know, I can live with some things. So even some of these people do have, when you talk to them, some way they will move on these issues. I mean, one thing that is frustrating with the covering this violence in Mexico, you see this suffering, these stories, this pain, and you think there must be some way that people can make this better. There's got to be some way that people can improve this and not live with this level of murder and violence.
Yoan Grillo, thanks for joining us. It was a great pleasure.
Fantastic to be here, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG and First Republic Bank, and from listeners like you. Today's episode was produced by Joanne Jennings, Jared Sport, Teresa Katsourilis, and Madeline Wood. Tatum Sanderbeck and Temba Daniels provided production assistance. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.